3, 16 through 23. Do you not know that you are a temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? If any man destroys the temple of God, God will destroy him, for the temple of God is holy, and that is what you are. Let no man deceive himself. If any man among you thinks he is wise in this age, he must become foolish, so that he may become wise. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness before God, for it is written, he is the one who catches the wise in their craftiness. And again, the Lord knows the reasoning of the wise, that they are useless. So then let no one boast in men, for all things belong to you. Whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or things present or things to come, all things belong to you. You belong to Christ, and Christ belongs to God. Now, to put this particular piece in context, Paul has just finished admonishing the Corinthians about their lack of maturity. They desire to follow men in the person of various preachers rather than following God. And this practice was dividing the church, and by the divisions or factions, the work of the church was being hindered. This was not what Paul or any other responsible minister would want. And Paul explains they were like nursing babies, but they had been babies for too long. His term is fleshly, meaning they are taking after the flesh rather than using spiritual discernment and measuring issues in terms of spiritual values, which are quite different than fleshly values. And so they're using the knowledge and customs they had before salvation to function in the church. And this fleshly wisdom is leading them off in the wrong direction. The church needed to grow and get past the milk stage or the fleshly stage. Now, it's understandable in a brand new Christian, he has no depth or maturity yet. And it's the work of the church to produce mature Christians, and this is very important work. And so Paul is vitally interested in the process. And so he's compared the work to a field where he planted and Apollos watered. And in this, there's two important facts. Both Paul and Apollos were on the same team, but God was causing the growth. Apparently, the Corinthians had missed that fact. And Paul then compared the church to a building. As a man who started the Corinthian church, Paul laid the foundation of the church, and he cautioned that the foundation he laid was Christ. No one can lay a different foundation. Any attempt to use a man or men as a foundation for the church should set off alarm bells. No man can be the foundation of the church, and the following of various men or arguments over which man should we follow, it's all foolishness. These men cannot be the foundation of the church. No man can be. The foundation must be Christ. And so, because the foundation of the church is Christ, any man who presumes to build on the foundation has got to be prudent. He's got to be careful about how he builds. His work's going to be tested for quality. If the work is found to be good, the man can expect to receive a reward. And so, because the church needed maturity, Paul used these examples of babies needing milk rather than solid food, planting and watering in a field, building on a foundation. These are examples of edification or building up of the church in the process of maturity. And now he turns to members, and in the opening verse of our text, he says that they are a temple of God. And he explains the Spirit of God dwells in them. Any person in the ancient world knew about temples because they were everywhere. And they were great buildings. They were not people. And there was the temple in Jerusalem, but there was also many other temples in the ancient world, and the people went to those places to worship. And to destroy any temple was seen as the ultimate insult to the God worshipped there and would expose those who destroyed the temple to the wrath of that God. In the Middle East today, you see various factions going about and destroying this or that temple or shrine, essentially trying to prove two things. They're, number one, insulting whoever holds that temple or shrine dear, and number two, they're saying, because we have the power and authority to destroy it, the way we do it's better. The way we do it is better. That is the argument about the Temple Mount in Jerusalem in a nutshell. And because the temple was destroyed and because an Islamic mosque was built, that sends a certain message which the Islamic world does not want to have turned on its head. That's the big problem with Jerusalem and why it can't be solved. And so Paul explains that because the believer is the temple of God, to destroy that temple is to incur the wrath of God. And so the context here is building in the church. The actual building has been compared to the individual members. They're called the temple of God. And so as a wise master builder, Paul laid the foundation. He said the foundation is Christ. And it's not one kind of foundation among many or one option. So we can't go poured concrete, cinder block, pressure-treated wood. There's one foundation, only one. And so this is the same for the individual members. If the member is the temple, the foundation has got to be identical. Christ and only Christ is the foundation of their faith. And so, like any building, the kind and character of the building matches the foundation. And so this brings out the value of the foundation to the subsequent building, and the folly of following mere men when the church should be following Christ. So the local culture that they were living in, where various teachers vied for followers and the support from followers, was coming into the church. But the church is not supposed to run on secular wisdom. The church is not supposed to have as a foundation a number of men or one man, or the wisdom of men as doctrine. The way to ruin the local church and the way to ruin the believer in the local church is to follow men or follow the doctrine of men. So chase various human leaders and try to ground the church on them. In so doing, you'll receive the wrath of God. Look at the various mainline churches out there which have adopted or embraced doctrines of men. They tend to be struggling. They're losing members. There's major battles even today between factions that want to follow the doctrines of men and those that want to remain faithful to the doctrines of the Bible. Other churches which have become something of a personality cult in following a particular preacher can be seen to decline after that person dies and leaves the scene. And so Paul goes on to say that if any man thinks he's wise in this age, he better become foolish. Now, do you think this applies to Allegheny and Olean today? I would tell you it does apply. So what are we doing? Well, advertising, marketing, packaging, these are things you must do. What's your target market? Identify your target market. I've been to the seminar. Identify your competition. How are you going to beat your competition? Set goals. Make sure they're measurable. Make sure they're achievable. Tap into the youth market. Use young and attractive people to sell. Promise anything. Put stuff into fine print. Above all, close the sale. And so, we're seeing attempts to put a lot of this wisdom to work in the local church. When I see gambling in the local church used to raise money, I cringe. What are you doing? Does it work? Is that the only thing we use to measure it? If I see a local church festival where the focal point is what? The beer tent. I grieve. What are we doing? What kind of wisdom are we using? When I see belly dancing in a skimpy costume to help raise funds for the local church, it strains my credulity. I look at the paper, I see it. I say, how can this be happening? I don't know. But the local culture, the local wisdom, the fleshly wisdom, the total lack of spiritual maturity is driving all these things. If you run a church with a free will offering where people just give because their heart is stirred to give, it's counter to logic. It's counter to fleshly wisdom. And if you're looking at fleshly wisdom, you better get foolish. The local culture and the local wisdom cannot be the foundation of the church, because the church is, or the church should be, a different type, a different style of organization. In many ways, the church is not logical. In many ways, the church is not rational, according to human wisdom. The things we value are not necessarily valued in secular terms, and that's why we have to beware of secular logic. Now, when I sat at the bargaining table, and I did many, many, many times, it was my custom to trade short-term things for long-term things. And I did that successfully many times. The underlying theory is employees come and go, but the organization remains. So a short-term gain could be anything lasting maybe in a 4-year contract, 5 years. For another benefit, could take 10 years to come to fruition. The employees at the table could be looking to retire. They could be all gone on both sides. But the organization would continue. And so they would reap the benefits of careful bargaining. Now, if you wonder where I'm going with this, that's nothing compared to the church, because the church carries this theory to the logical extreme. We look at short-term, long-term, and eternity. Guess what? You're the short-term adults. 20 years, 30 years, maybe 40 years. That's a short-term. Children might be here at another church for the balance of their life. Could be a long time. They're the long-term future of the church. From their ranks come preachers, teachers, deacons, leaders of tomorrow. Why do we put an emphasis on children? Long-term planning, long-term benefit. But the church doesn't stop there. We teach salvation leading to eternal life. That benefit has no end. Human organizations don't look for eternity. It's beyond their grasp. It's also outside of their grasp because they can't grasp the idea. They're looking at the bottom line from month to month and make decisions based on that. No organization outside of the church can expect an eternal lifespan. In fact, a human organization which reaches the age of 100 can congratulate itself. They have a big to-do about it, 100th anniversary, 50th anniversary. I spoke at the Board of Public Utilities 100th anniversary in Jamestown. That was a big deal. But the church is closing in on the age of 2,000. And it's still going. But guess what? To the saints in glory, that's a drop in the bucket. And so, with that viewpoint, we hear Paul saying, if you think you're smart, you better get foolish. Because the God brings to nothing the cleverness of the wise. So, in light of eternal glory or eternal punishment, the wisdom of God is foolishness. The wisdom of man, I'm sorry, is foolishness in the eyes of God. It's short-term stuff. Remember our recent message about a rich farmer. This was all a question of a point of view. The farmer was rich. He was blessed by God. He couldn't even store all the goods he had. And he made plans to keep it and consume everything. And God said to him, your soul is going to be required of you this very night. Who's going to get all this stuff? The Lord knows the reasonings of the wise, and in his eyes, they're useless. Because secular wisdom sets secular goals and reaches for secular rewards. And in light of eternity, these are all extreme short-term goals. So remember, in the eyes of God, we're like grass that's going to wither away. So that's like sitting at the bargaining table and say, if you give me a bonus next week, and I can have it now, you can cut my pay in half the week after that and for the next 5 years. Does that sound like a good deal? But that's exactly what the secular wisdom is doing. You're going to use up your life chasing money and stuff, and then at the end, what do you got? Paul goes back to the central issue of foolishly following men. He says, let no one boast in men. Now, I remember back in the day, we used to have football cards and baseball cards. They came in bubble gum back then. And we had the stars on there, and the boys had one or another of them picked out, and they would say, oh, my guy is greater than your guy, and my guy can do this, my guy can do that. Batting averages, season totals of home runs. Remember any of that? On the football field, touchdowns, passes, yards, majority of the men who appeared on those cards we had are in the graveyard now. Not many people talk about them anymore. They might be discussed from time to time. They're not all dead. I see some guy on TV trying to sell something for Medicare all the time. He's beat up and wrinkled, but he used to be pretty good. He's trading on past fame, but I don't think he could do much on the football field. I don't know if he could even run 100 yards now. If anyone was going to boast about him, they were going to have to say, well, back in the old days, he could have done this or that. And so Paul goes on to explain the reason not to boast in men, and he expands this to speak in ownership in some detail. And so he says, let no one boast in men, for all things belong to you, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or things present or things to come, all things belong to you. And so he's saying, we do not belong to men. We are not following men. Rather, they belong to us. So whoever stands in this pulpit, it doesn't matter whether it's our pastor or a different pastor or a guest speaker or myself or anybody else, you do not belong to them. They belong to you. Christ said, the Gentile leaders lord it over their followers. But you are not to be like this. For whoever wishes to be great must become a servant. For I did not come to serve, or to be served, but to serve. I came to serve and to give my life a ransom for many. And so, as a leader, he belonged to them in a very special way. And so Paul is saying, these men, whether it be Paul or Cephas or Apollos, came as servants to lead them to Christ. And as faithful servants, they belong to the congregation. They're for the congregation. The congregation is not for them. Their teaching is for the people. Their sacrifice is done for the love of God and the love of the people. So the congregation, as I said before, does not belong to the man that stands in the pulpit. He belongs to them. He's for them. And so as Paul takes these ministers, he says they belong to the Corinthians, but there's more than that. Because the Corinthians are Christians, because they're saved, because they are in Christ, he explains all things are theirs. They have assurance of many things, the world, life or death, things in the present or things in the future belong to them. And because all these things belong to them, in a very real sense, they cannot belong to some individual. And this is important, because any time any individual, and I don't care if this is a preacher, I don't care if it's a political leader, or who it might be, if he's trying to bend the people's will till they belong to him, I immediately think something like Charles Manson. Okay? I immediately think of something like drink this Kool-Aid when all the followers died down in South America. Okay? We deal with the world on a daily basis. It's much in our thoughts and plans. But if the world belongs to the Christians, if the meek are going to inherit the earth, the world can't own them. If the men who are in leadership roles belong to the Christians, the men can't own them. This present life cannot own them. What you own cannot then own you. You own it. You can take it or leave it. You can dispose of it. You can enjoy it. You can use it up. But it can't own you. And so we can't live our lives in fear of death, for Paul explains death cannot own them, because death is one of the things they own. Whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or things present or things to come, all things belong to you. Christ has conquered death. Too often we live and struggle in the present while we worry about the future. How can I get through today, and what in the world am I going to do tomorrow? The present life, or things present, cannot own them. Nor can worry over the future or things future, for they own the present and the future. Now, I'm not saying that you will never have any trouble. And I don't think Paul is saying that you'll never have any trouble. But he is saying that as a Christian, whether the world or life or death or things present or things to come, all things belong to you. And so then you might say, why do all things belong to me? How do all things belong to me? When will all things belong to me? And he goes on and he says, you belong to Christ, and Christ belongs to God. And so if we through Christ belong to God, who owns everything beyond any doubt, then we certainly also have an ownership in all things. We're joint heirs. We're adopted into the family by the kind intention of his will. He wants us in the family. And so in that case, if worldly wisdom tells you that this or that or a man or a job or a leader owns you, and secular wisdom is telling you that, no matter how wise you are, get foolish. Get foolish. Come to an organization that makes no sense, and we can all be foolish together and enjoy it while we're doing it. We'll have our closing hymn now.